Spacey here, and welcome to the Disney Positive Podcast. It's the podcast where I talk about Disney-related topics with people who I think have a positive impact on the world. Or another way of putting it, I talk with people I think have a positive impact on the world, and then I make them talk about Disney. In this case, though, I think I don't have to force my guests to talk about Disney. I feel like there's serious Disney pedigree here. I don't know if that's the right use of the word, but I am so happy to have these two fine guests with me. I'll just basically introduce them, let you say hi, you know, let them say hi. I will say hi to them. Please welcome my guests calling in from Tennessee, the volunteer state. They're doing this of their own free will, I believe. So please welcome Andrew Simmons and Fallon Danita. Please say hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Can I read some little bios that I have, mini bios about you guys?
Absolutely.
Sure.
All right. Andrew Simmons is a 15-year animation veteran of the Walt Disney Feature Animation Studio in Orlando, Florida, and has worked on many. I'm going to basically interject here because there were some movies that weren't mentioned in the bio. I'm going to mention them here. Many classic movies, The Little Mermaid, The Lion King, Pocahontas, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Hercules, Mulan, Lilo and Stitch, and Brother Bear, you know, to name a few, doing various jobs such as cell painter, traditional film camera operator, 2D animation processor, and final check. And then we also have Fallon's bio, which I will read now. Fallon Danita is a Belmont University graduate with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Motion Pictures with an emphasis in screenwriting. She has been working freelance jobs in the industry over the past year, from curating pitch decks to production management. She loves writing, drawing, spending time with her family, and working on cool projects that inspire hope and positivity in the world. I love that. Did I do a good job? Did I get it right?
I think so.
Wonderful. I always like to ask because I, you know, if I get it wrong or if I move things around in the bio, I like to give you guys a big boost from the get-go so people know that we mean business. So maybe we could talk about what brings you here. And that's a project that you both are working on, but it's spearheaded by Andrew, and it's The Flower. I wonder if you can talk about that and talk about how it's being brought to life after so many years since its original inception back at the Disney Studios. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. Originally, I started The Flower when I was working in the camera department, and it was just the idea to start learning on my own. I actually dropped out of college to take the job at Disney. So while I was hired there, it was just the prime opportunity to learn everything that I could. I mean, I can count the number of times I got kicked out of editorial for being in there when I shouldn't. You know, but when you're in such a creative environment like that, it's just awesome to be able to take advantage of everybody's knowledge that was there. And I started learning about storytelling and different things, and took the reins to start doing my own little short. And we would work on it basically during downtime between the films. And we actually got a fair bit done while we were there before they closed us out in 2004.
That's right. Yeah, it's interesting to think that it was just that short period of time, like during that what we could call the Disney Renaissance period. And that's really it's so interesting to think, you know, at the time when I think the rise of like the non-traditionally animated films, like the push towards CGI films, I feel like it was right around that same period. But I love the idea of like being where you shouldn't, you know, as far as that being part of your is that like the kind of artist that you are, is that you're going to put yourself in these situations where you will learn as much as you can, even if you're technically not supposed to be there, like whatever that means.
Well, I had been in love with animation since I was a child, and the idea of ending up working in a place like that was just amazing. And to be able to go around and you know, I would do some weekends, or I'd come in on the weekends and do effects tests and just learning everything that I could about the entire process. I always felt that, you know, the more you know about something, the better you are able to use it and utilize it and understand how it works and functions. And that was kind of always one of my goals. Of course, you know, it would have been great to move into effects. That didn't happen, but just the idea to be able to sit down with effects artists and say, why do you draw this like that? And to be able to learn from them was just an incredible bit. And a very humbling too, you know, at the same time, because there was so many people. Our studio was a great place to work at. There was just so many people that were willing to spend time to help you and to help you learn. And You know, I was very blessed, very fortunate indeed. And I was very fortunate to actually be able to take the flower with me when I left, which was, I think, almost kind of unheard of at the time.
That's right, because, you know, Disney lawyers are a thing. They will.
Yes, they are a thing.
which is, I'm sure you probably know from firsthand experience, just the fact that you have the project that was in development at Disney. That's the amazing thing, is that it was in development. You took the project with you, and now it's going to be it's going to be part of the lore, I think, of Disney. Not only like Disney films that, you know, never saw the light of day, but then maybe one day they did. One that comes to mind is like the collaboration between Walt Disney and Salvador Dali, you know, Destinos, you know, the fact that it took years and years and years. And finally, you know, they as a company finally produced it. But I think this is going to be something on that level. So I'm looking forward to this being completed. Obviously you have the Kickstarter, and I'd love, you know, for people to go and check that out. If you want to give a pitch for that and tell people how they can find that. And I'd love to have people know more about that.
Fallon, you want to cover that one, or do you want me to?
I'll do the pitching.
Well, I feel like Fallon also is in a position where if you talk about somebody being where they shouldn't, or, you know, trying to learn as much as they can. No. That has a tone to it, doesn't it?
I bothered Andrew until he let me be a part of this.
I feel like that kind of attitude is rewarded more often than not. Is if you knock on the right doors hard enough and long enough, then I feel like that's really the only way. You never get what you don't ask for, right?
So exactly. Yeah, the worst somebody can do is say no.
Exactly. And I wonder if you can talk about how you came to discover the project, Fallon. And
it was very funny. So we both know Tom Bancroft, who is a very prolific Disney animator and artist.
Of course.
And he's a good friend of Andrew's, and he's actually one of my instructors right now at some extra courses I'm taking at Lipscomb University. And I'd had the pleasure of working on another Kickstarter right before this that unfortunately did not do as well as anyone had hoped. They pulled the Kickstarter and they've taken other avenues since then that have been very successful, but the Kickstarter route didn't work. But I was brought on to kind of help assist the Kickstarter, and I just totally got the bug. I was like, I am amazed at how Kickstarters work and how independent creators are using them. Like, I mean, I was super inspired by like Tara Billinger and Tracy J. Butler. I'm like, they are astounding how they've created these amazing pieces of content, and it's all been through like crowdfunding. So I just got really into it, and Tom noticed. And so he called me one day and he was like, you know, I'm really sorry that the last Kickstarter didn't work. And I was like, yeah, it's okay. You know, I mean, it was an interesting thing to be a part of, and I learned a whole lot. I loved helping out on it, you know. And then he goes, do you want to do another one? And I'm like, sure. And then that was pretty much it. Like, that's what's great about Tom, is he'll call you and be like, hey, you want a job? And you're like, yeah. And then like 2 days later, you're doing something that you have no idea even how you got on board with it. I love getting jobs from Tom. They're like my favorite thing ever. And so that was sort of what happened. He was like, so I know this Disney guy, right? And I'm like, okay. And he's like, 20 years in the making. There's this, there's long lost Disney film. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm on board. He goes, and he needs somebody to help with the Kickstarter, and it's going to be amazing. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, he's got Disney art, and he's got, you know, he's got like Tim Hodges storyboards, and he's got the cell drawings of the animation. And I'm just like, this is amazing. And that's sort of what happened. It literally just kind of spiraled out of control like that.
Well, that's the best kind of spiraling out of control.
It was the best spiral.
Right.
And then I think like the next day, Andrew and I met over Zoom, and we were kind of off to the races. So yeah, that was, I guess that's part of my pitch right there, is we have a Kickstarter, and it is, I'm helping with the project management and like social media aspect of it, which has been very fun. So you can find us on Instagram at the Flower Animated Film, with underscores in between the words. And you can also find us at, like, you know, the Flower 2D animated film on Kickstarter. We are lucky enough to be a project Kickstarter loves. So Very Wonderful. Excited and honored about that. Yeah, we're pretty easy to find. There's the official Flower website. You can, you know, you can check us out on a, I think Tim Hodge and Tom Bancroft have both posted about us somewhere in their timelines, and we're all over that corner of Instagram, so you can find us. And the Kickstarter has been up for about, I think, almost 2 weeks. Tomorrow will be 2 weeks, and we offer, you know, some very amazing rewards. You can, like I mentioned before, you can pick up storyboards by Tim Hodge. You can pick up cell drawings that are, you know, from 20 years ago during, you know, the time when Disney was still drawing on paper. So drawings like these don't even exist anymore in the modern animation world. They're right, they're sort of obsolete. There's some other really cool stuff. We got like a really stylish journal with the flower logo on it, some cool stickers. Like, I mean, there's just lots of cool, like they're really, you know, the standard Kickstarter stuff. It's fun. And it was a lot of fun to make the Kickstarter. And so I hope people have fun looking at it and seeing what we're offering. But there's a lot of really cool art, a lot of really cool opportunity. There's some art prints by Tim Hodge that are available. We even have some larger tiers that are open for businesses or, you know, people that would like to sponsor the film and be like listed in the credits and kind of be, you know, shouted out by on social media and things like that. So yeah, it's a very interesting project, and I love being a part of it. I love how I kind of got onto it. That's the funniest part, I think, of it. But it's been such an awesome experience, and I'm obviously very excited about the idea of bringing to life something that just feels like a very little known fact about animation history. I feel like this is kind of making history.
Exactly. I feel like that's the appeal to me, is that people might, you know, even the most avid Disney fans or people who know everything about Disney, I feel like this is one of those things that if you don't know it, to discover it and be able to be part of funding it, I think that's a really great opportunity. And the great thing about crowdfunding, of course, is that it, you know, on a level of like entrepreneurship, to make it yourselves the way you want to, you know, true to the vision of the traditional 2D animation that's not really in vogue anymore, because it's sort of a time consuming process. But also, you know, expanding the pool of investors to, you know, beyond the traditional circle, like, oh, you have to be super rich or you have to be whatever. No, anybody at various levels can get involved for relatively small amounts of money, and they can have a part to play in bringing this to life. And I'm so excited that I have you guys on. I've said that a few times already, but you know, I'm just excited to have you guys. We're happy to be here. and Andrew, I wonder if you can talk about the story of the flower, what inspired it originally, because it takes place in 15th century Japan, correct?
Yes, that is correct. Back when I was in, again, you know, the traditional camera period time, where I was learning a lot about film camera and camera moves and cinematography and things like that. The idea to do something of my own, I was always, I don't want to say enthralled, if you would, but I love the original stuff that Walt did years ago, the original Fantasia, with just, you know, set the music. I'm very, very big on music. I think music plays a fantastic role in film, and it can drive emotion sometimes more than actually the spoken word can. So I've always, you know, the idea is, well, let's do a short film. But let's not actually have any talking in it, because let's just focus on what we can tell. So if we can move people without, you know, words per se, then imagine what I can do when I actually let people talk. But, you know, the idea is to have something along that, the shorts, you know, that were done. And I was previously, and I still am, a big fan of Nick Parks and the shorts that he was doing back in the day. And also a very huge fan of Akira Kurosawa's body of work. I was able to see some of his films in the theater as a teen. And it was just the impression that the samurai culture had on me was huge. And so when I started, you know, mashing around ideas to try to come up with something, basically the flower is kind of what came out, but something that was a little bit different. We were really trying to go for visual poetry, and that was kind of like the tagline when somebody, we would describe it to people. It's like, well, what is it about? It's like visual poetry. It's like what you see, but hopefully gives you the emotional feelings of some of the best poems you know of.
That's something about that certain style of filmmaking is when you can tell a story almost like a silent film, and yet you also, it's not truly silent because you have music an accompaniment or almost synergistically telling the story. It's like the Star Wars films. You know, they were like described originally as like silent films by George Lucas, because if you stripped all the dialogue off and you have just John Williams' score and the visuals, you basically have the story, because of the strength of the medium is that if you can tell a story visually strongly, then words are almost, they should just be in support of what you're seeing and what you're feeling from the visuals and the music. So yeah, I wonder, boy, I usually ask this question from the top, but I'm going to start it now. This is a question that can inspire, and this might be ground we've already covered, but maybe you can answer this and then we'll discover that for myself. I'll discover it for myself. You know, we'll see if that's the case. And that question I usually start with is, who are you and what makes you that way? And it usually results in some really interesting questions, or I guess questions, but answers, I should say. So I wonder who would want to start in terms of who are you and what makes you that way?
Ladies first.
Of course. Why am I not surprised? I think I should put in here that I am the one that has dragged Andrew to basically every public appearance he's made. And he doesn't love to speak in front of people, and I have been completely ignoring that in our pursuit to promote this Kickstarter. So it's only fair that I have to go first on all of these things. I don't know who am I and what made me that way. I'm a writer. I think that's the biggest thing. When you talk about like what makes you you and what makes you who you are, I think, you know, my family and my faith has been, that's probably what makes me on like the spiritual level. You know, I'm very spiritual, you know, my faith is a huge deal to me. God is very important. He's at the center of my life. And my family has been, you know, they're my rock, they're my main support. And they have, my mom and brother especially, are my biggest fans and my biggest supporters. And they help me be kind of the person that I want to be, and helping me become like the woman that I want to be for the rest of my life. And so I think that's a big deal of probably like what made me who I am was that, you know, their love and support. And I, from a different side of it, I've always been a writer. When I was very little, I mean like 2 and 3, I would force my parents to listen to me make up stories. And they would go on for like hours, and we lived in a really small town. And so the nearest mall was like an hour away, and I would just talk in the car for an hour all the way there and an hour all the way back, just making up stories that I don't know if they even made any sense, but they made sense to me. And then, you know, my parents would just, bless them, they'd have to just listen and be supportive. I'd start talking, and then I got wise, and I'd be like, I don't know if they're listening. So then I started quizzing them, and then they had to pay attention. They couldn't tune me out. So, that's me. I think that's, I think that's as close as we're going to get as to who are you. That says a lot about me, I think. But Andrew's like dying over there.
No, I love that quality of a person where they, it's to make sure someone's listening. You start, that's what my wife does to me, is she'll start to ask questions, and I'll say, I guess I wasn't paying attention. I'm sorry. She's taught me, you know, over these years of being married, to listen better. You know, but then I guess that's the thing. If you're telling a story and you have an hour to tell it, then you probably would want to check in on your audience to make sure, are you following along? Are you, you know, that's,
oh goodness. I don't know. I think that's part of that's something that I really feel for them trying. They had to pretend they were interested and pretend that they were, you know, that I was some sort of amazing storyteller when I was like, you know, 2 and just babbling about nonsense. But
I imagine as your parents, they probably thought you were pretty wonderful, you know, at 2 and 3 years old.
They like me, and I like them. I think I'll keep them around. But that was where it sort of started. And then I got older, the stories got more complex and they started making more sense. And then when I was, it's funny, when I was 12, that was when I decided, my whole life I was like, oh, I'm going to write books. And I do still write books and I enjoy it a lot. But when I was 12 or 13, I was like, oh my God, you know, I think I want to do movies. And it was always animation. And I didn't realize until I got into film school that I was into animation. I was just like, oh, all my favorite movies are cartoons. It never occurred to me that was because I was primarily interested in animation. I was just like, well, yeah, I just love watching cartoons. I thought everyone watched them as much as I did, kind of, you know. And then I knew they didn't, but I never really thought of it, kind of thing, I guess. I don't know. And then mm-hmm. I got into film school, and I was like, let's talk about animation. And everyone's like, no. And I'm like, why? And it was just it was very funny. And
well, you had to find your people, of course.
I did.
You?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just kind of built since then. I'm really into the idea of writing things that inspire people to be better and that teach people to be who they want to be. You know, I have a younger brother, and I kind of noticed what he was watching on TV as I grew up. And I was like, there's not that there's not good shows on now, because there really are. We've had kind of a great renaissance of children's animation recently, but it was just kind of like, I was watching these shows and I was like, I had better shows when I was little. Like, the shows seemed to be declining in quality, and it, like, I don't know if they did or didn't, or if that was just my perspective, but it got me thinking. And then I was like, well, I want to make shows and movies that inspire people to be good people and teach kids how to be, you know, great and how to be successful. And I think there's a lot of, like, stuff in the world that sucks, but I think one of the best things is that we are blessed with the ability to create. And totally. I think probably what makes me is sort of this unstoppable urge to just create things that inspire people to be better, or to be who they want to be, and to achieve their dreams. And I think inspiring hope in people is one of the strongest things that you can do. And I just want to do that no matter what. So
that's
a very long answer to your question.
Well, no, that's the fun part, is it's a small question, but it's a deceptively small question. You know what I mean? It inspires a lot of self-inspection, probably in the same way that deciding, you know, what you want to be when you grow up, and who, you know, that requires you to look at yourself and look at other people around you. And it's like, is this conducive to what I want? You know, and it's like, so maybe your interest, you know, being interested in animation and that type of storytelling, and maybe finding finding that people around you weren't, it's shocking in a way, but it's also like, it gives you opportunity to confront it and then be like, okay, do I want to be, you know, who likes what I like? Who also wants to make, you know, help me.
Right.
You know, and like I said, finding your people, it's a journey of self-discovery, but also discovering other selves, I guess.
It's also great how much you can bond with people, even when your, you know, interests are so different that way. Like, right. I learned right. so much from my peers at film school and from my teachers. And even though they didn't always understand what I was trying to do, you know, they're over here trying to, like, help me write a story that fits some sort of, like, adult narrative. And I'm like, no, but I want there to be these, like, random crazy things that happen, because it's for kids. And there was a disconnect, but it, you know, it was amazing how much we learned from one another. And I don't know. I wouldn't trade that for anything. I don't think I loved how different, everyone's perspectives were, and learning what made people tick. I think that was one of my favorite things about being at kind of, you know, being in that concentrated environment at Belmont. It was like, okay, every one of us, we've got different ways that we all work, and figuring out why we all worked that way was pretty fascinating. You know, cause we were all trying to do the same thing, which was ultimately to inspire people. And it was fun seeing the different paths that we took to get to that same conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if there's some parallels though with Andrew, when he came to Disney, and if he found lots of different ways of working and operating, and yet somehow at the end of the day, everyone has to kind of work together ultimately, you know, toward a common goal of whether it's, you know, in one situation you're learning, and then on the other, you're producing, you know, Disney animated films. So, Andrew, I wonder what your answer would be to the question of who are you and what makes you that way?
I could probably sum that up in one word, Marines. Yeah, my dad was a Marine.
Oh, I see how it is.
Yeah, the short, concise answer. No, my dad spent 25 years in the Marine Corps, and I grew up with a lot of the values that were instilled upon me regarding, you know, being a Marine, honor, fealty, loyalty, things like that. So those are things that naturally I was attracted to. And especially as I had six boys of my own, which we raised, and those are the qualities that I wanted to instill in them. And when you go to look at the classic qualities of honor, and you start seeing those over and over and over again, basically in film, movie, you know, books, different things like that. Cause I grew up on a lot of the older, you know, some black and whites, you know, Robin Hood and Errol Flynn and different things, you know, and that's kind of what I wanted to emulate, and that's what I wanted to write about and in my writing. And that's where, you know, when it came to learning more about the Japanese culture, you know, it was translating basically what the Western idea of what a knight was to what the Eastern idea of what, you know, kind of what's equatable, what a samurai was. Those are just the things that, you know, insight, I don't want to say insight, but just excite me, that, you know, I find worthy. Again, you know, like what Fallon said, writing stories that provide hope, you know, writing stories where people are able to overcome obstacles to achieve a greater good. That's pretty much right along my timeline.
That's, yeah. And it's interesting that when you talk about the samurai and their, you know, the qualities of who you are and what makes you that way, basically one who serves. That's basically what a samurai is.
Yes.
That code of honor and, you know, just how you live your life. It's not just like something that you adopt at, you know, from 9 to 5. It's all day, you know, it's that way of life basically. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, my dad was, he was in the army. During the Korean conflict. And so I have a familial connection where I have such great respect and appreciation. So thank you. I assume, so your dad was in the Marines.
In the Marines, yes, sir.
Did you serve as well?
The 18 years from when I grew up to when he got out, I count those as my service.
There you go. Yeah. Yep.
I almost went back. I almost did join up, but then Disney fell in my lap. So you can't turn Disney down.
No, certainly cannot. So I wonder if we could go into, I have a little wheel of Disney topics. I wonder if we'd care to spin it, if you guys want to see where it lands and talk about the topics. I don't know if you're into that or not.
Sure. Sounds fun.
Does it sound fun? Because there's a little, you know, we have some theme music and there's prizes. There's no prizes. You don't win anything.
I always say,
podcast is the prize enough.
Hey, there you go.
Exactly. No, I always say anything once, twice, if it doesn't hurt.
There you go. There you go.
That's our approach to Kickstarter management.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's that time again. We're going to play a little game of topics that we call the Wheel of Disney Positivity. So what we're going to do is we're going to have both of you spin the wheel in your mind, and whatever topic it lands on, we have to discuss it. How does that sound?
Sounds interesting. Let's roll it out. Let's do this thing.
Let's try it.
All right. So go ahead and spin that wheel together.
I'd like it to eat that.
So it's spinning, and it's landing on... This is interesting. Sad and tragic stories. I believe this was from Fallon, correct?
Yes, this was mine.
So, okay. Let me
set this up. So, okay, a while back, Andrew, stop that face. A while back, we were, I was talking with some friends, and we were actually in an adaptation class, or adaptation screenwriting class at Belmont, and I decided to do my take on Tarzan. So I obviously went back and was reading the original source material because I'm a huge Tarzan fan. I love
Edgar Rice Burroughs. Yeah.
Yes. Well, the Disney Tarzan movie is one of my favorite Disney movies ever. I've watched tons of other Tarzan movies. I've even watched like the 1930s one. Like, I just love Tarzan. And I was reading the book and I was having this sort of like existential discussion with my friend about how much you should be allowed to adapt a story, you know, like where's the line between taking someone else's content that was years and years, years ago and making it entirely your own? We were just sort of having like a moral discussion about that. And we didn't really reach any conclusion. So I'm not going to go into like what we said, because there's not enough time on the podcast, but we like Tarzan was brought up and he was like, you know, well, you're doing Tarzan, like you're doing your own take on Tarzan. I'm like, yeah, but should I be? I don't know if like I'm allowed, like, I don't know where that line is. And so I'm reading the Tarzan book and I'm like, oh, I have every right to make this better. Cause I just like the Tarzan book that, you know, it's old and it's just got, there's just stuff in there that isn't in Tarzan movies anymore, for better. And it got me thinking about, and Andrew, you worked on Hunchback, so this is relevant as well. It got me thinking about like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is a horribly sad and tragic story, like just awful. And Disney turned it into this like overwhelmingly inspirational movie about triumph and identity and, you know, even spirituality to an extent. And I was just very fascinated. And so I'm very pro taking sad and tragic stories and turning them into incredible stories that are inspiring. And I think Disney does that pretty well. I think Hunchback is the best example. But yeah, that was sort of that's the setup to why I want to talk about tragedy on the Disney Positive podcast. But it was just this thought about like, you know, I love that Disney does that. I love, cause like, I mean, by all accounts, the Hunchback of Notre Dame movie is not the story that the book told. It isn't the same.
Correct.
The name is the same and the place is similar, but it's really not the same. And it's sort of amazing that they took something that was just this, I mean, there's not really any redemption. There's no catharsis. The book is just so sad and it just kind of kicks you while you're down. And then they took the Disney movie and they made it something that was just beautiful. And I love that. And I think as a writer, that's something that's fun. You know, I'm adapting a story right now that's from the public domain and I'm changing stuff around. And it's like, you know, oh, I get to make this constructive. That's going to be so much fun. Like, you know, I'm like, I get to do good with this. And so I love that Disney does that. I don't know. It's a very weird thing that probably no one else has ever really wanted to talk about, but I think it's interesting.
And that's all that matters. You know, if it's interesting to you, then you're going to find an audience where it's always the best things are the ones where it's like the people making it love it no matter what. And then people just kind of glom onto it like, oh, I'm along for the ride for this, because, you know, that can take you very, very far. A passion for a story, especially if in the end, if it's inspiring, you know, that's always an added plus. You know,
it's right.
Because I've noticed that too. You know, I read the original Hunchback of Notre Dame and everybody dies. Everybody gets deaded in that one. You know, not in the movie, but you know.
Except Phoebus. He gets to live. Like Phoebus lives. I'm like, that's not cool. Like, that's wrong. Like, yeah, I get it. Like I don't know. And then it's so funny, like Disney, they made Phoebus like he's like the best honorary, like him and David from Lilo and Stitch are like the best honorary Disney princes. So I went back to like look at the book to be like, I wonder what Phoebus was like in the novel. And oh, that was a mistake. I was like, oh, never mind. I don't want to know anymore.
Yeah, not so great. But also even stories like The Little Mermaid, you know, the original stories were changed by Disney. And I'm sure, Andrew, you could speak to this. You worked on The Little Mermaid, but is that something that you find to be what sets Disney apart, is that they are willing to take steps to transform a story that's maybe in the culture, but then they can change the ending, make it a happy ending, and it feels right. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel like sacrilegious in a way to change the end of the story that's been around for hundreds of years.
That's why they're called inspired by.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, you know, when you're telling a film for an audience, one of the things that I picked up on years ago when I was just a wee little lad and learning is that one of the biggest things an audience will literally latch onto is hope. Because they hope, they want to see that the hero is going to succeed. He's going to beat the bad guy, or he's going to overcome the obstacle, or whatever the case may be. And hope, you know, it's the biggest driving factor. For instance, you can make one of the best movies that is completely negative, and I would point to something like Seven, which is a fantastic film, but the ending of it is so rough that you're going to be like, I am never going to watch that movie again.
It may I am be here a great, for this.
You're like, it may be a great film, which, you know, but I actually saw that in the theater and I literally walked out of the theater and went, okay, what's playing that's funny? I need something funny because that was just disturbing. So, but if you tell a story with hope and a story that does inspire, it's going to fulfill that need of, yes, the hero won, and that innate, I don't want to call it an innate need, but it kind of is. But it's also going to lend itself to repeat watching.
Sure.
And that's what you want. You want people to watch it not only once, but 5 times, 10 times. Love it. Get to memorize it like I did with so many movies back in the day. And today, and quote nonsense all the time. Yeah, I'm a movie quoter. Sorry.
Are you even in film if you don't speak fluent movie quotes? Like, I mean, yeah. I can't go like a day without making a movie reference. Like, and most of them are Disney because they're iconic, you know, like.
Absolutely.
And just so pervasive too. Like when you say it, it's usually most people are going to know what the reference is and they're going to get it, you know?
Right.
I doom myself by quoting very obscure things and they're like, what is that? and then I have to like reorient myself, like Hakuna Matata, you know.
When the kids were growing up, it was always Ohana means family. And then all the kids would echo, if family means nobody gets left behind.
Yes, that's really touching. I love that.
We do. My family's even more loving than that. We do the dishonor on you, dishonor on your cow. Like that is the Disney quote that prevails at my house. Like that is the one we picked. I wish we picked Ohana. That would have sounded much better. But now we went with the Mushu quote.
And this is for anyone who's listening who doesn't know. Tom Bancroft was the lead animator for Mushu.
Yes, and character designer. He designed
character
him as well.
And character designer. Yes. Yeah. So it's so you're a teacher. You know, it's interesting that it's a small. He has a role in spreading positivity and I was sad that, you know, in the new Mulan there was no Mushu, but I understand why there wasn't. But yeah. Well, not to bring the podcast down at all, but sad and tragic stories. There's in the ending, I didn't mention it. I just referred to it in passing. In The Little Mermaid, she turns in, you know, basically she turns into sea foam at the end by giving up, you know, being with the prince in the original story by Hans Christian Andersen, I believe. Mm-hmm. So that's a very kind of downer ending. Don't know if that's going to sell to the kids in, you know, 1989. So I think they made the right choice by making sure that she got to be with Prince Eric. And it's just so fascinating to think of how many stories, when you have the source material is sad or tragic, how many do they really lean into like the sad and tragic parts? It's probably not Disney animation per se, like the classic films. It's probably more like in the Marvel films, you'll have a Thanos, you know, he's the protagonist of Infinity War. And then by the end, he gets what he wants, but he's not the hero, except that he is by definition of that film. And we walked out of that movie and my wife was so upset. Think about it. It was like, my wife's never seen Seven, but I imagine it's kind of like what it would be like if she did see Seven and was expecting The Little Mermaid, you know. So she was so despondent, you know, when we were walking out to the car, and it took a whole year for her to get over it, because then we went and saw Endgame, and then you had, yes, the traditional, the heroes, you know, triumph over evil, and she was very, very happy. Very happy, because it inspired hope, and it inspires just, it doesn't make you regret, you know, that you bought a ticket. You know, that's your hard-earned money going into see a movie nowadays. Well, not nowadays. People stay at home, I guess. But, but you know, the traditional theater-going experience, you're going to pay a lot of money, and you want to have an experience where you're not depressed by the end of it. You know, yeah. I think I just spent a lot of time talking there.
It's all good. It's your podcast.
Well, yeah, I guess. But what I'm wondering is when I think of like Disney films, or, you know, and Disney, you know, it covers a lot of ground. There's, you know, Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. That's a good example, even though wasn't produced by Disney. It's now owned by Disney. Talk about a downer ending, a sad and tragic kind of story. But then they course corrected with Return of the Jedi, which as a kid, you know, I grew up, I was born in the 80s. Growing up, the Return of the Jedi was my, that was my Star Wars movie because it had the Ewoks and it had, you know, Luke Skywalker being an actual Jedi. You know, is that's it's just, yeah. it's funny to think about, you know, how there's ebb and flow when it comes to sad and tragic stories. Like we need, there's a place for them, but then we always need to have, I think, those loose ends tied up with a nice, pretty bow of hope.
Agreed. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cause if there's one thing that's, if there's one thing that's universal across cultures, that's hope. That's hope.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you guys. So, should we try and spin the wheel again, or do you have anything more to say about sad and tragic stories that have been transformed by Disney?
No, I think we can head out. I think you had a nice end cap on it there.
I think so. I think that was good. I think that was a moment. I think we had a moment there. All right. So if you guys want to, you're going to work together now this time, you're going to spin the wheel at the same time. Ready?
Ready.
In your minds, of course, it's not an actual physical tactile wheel, you know, it's a socially distanced wheel. I don't even have the wheel. It's all right. So go ahead and spin that wheel. All right. It's spinning, it's spinning, it's spinning, it's spinning. And it's landed on, okay, this is interesting. Disney villain songs. This is another one from Fallon. This is really, the wheel is favoring you today.
She's better looking.
I love Disney villain songs. I really like old Disney villain songs. I recently just did a blog post where I like picked the top 10 villains out of like any animated movie ever. It wasn't just Disney, but like so many Disney villains ended up on that list because like their songs were so good. And I was like, I can't deny the fact that they've got flair, you know, like I think I love Disney villain songs. I really, really love a good villain song. Yeah, I don't have much to say about this one other than just kind of nerding out over it. I love them. I love like Disney covers. Like I listen to like some really great artists that do like metal Disney covers, or like they're like a person of like the opposite gender will do like a gender swap version of the villain song. Like, I don't know. No, I get into that. I just love them. They're catchy and they're fun. And a lot of the times they're like the only song that I'll really still listen to after the movie is done. It's like, I'll be going on YouTube to look up the song and it's usually going to be the villains, with the exception of Tangled. I listen to all of Tangled songs. That's just a good movie and the series was good too. And I can say a lot about that, but that wasn't on the wheel. But anyway, I don't know. I love Disney villain songs. And I have to add though, this is kind of interesting because he wasn't a Disney villain, but the best villain song ever, and I will fight and argue over this, the best villain song ever was In the Dark of the Night from Anastasia, which was sung by Rasputin,
right? Right. And
right.
It's the one movie, Anastasia, where for years people kept mistaking it for a Disney film.
Right. It's because the song was so good. I think it's because it has that is the best villain song on an animated movie ever. And I'm really, really happy that Disney now owns Fox, because we can officially say he has the best Disney villain song as well. Like he takes all the trophies. Like that's just the best villain song. I love Rasputin. He's always been one of my favorite animated villains.
Well, it was voiced by Christopher Lloyd, you know, Back to the Future. It's Doc Brown. And but did you know that the singing voice of Rasputin is actually the same singing voice for certain parts of Be Prepared from The Lion King? Did you know this?
I did. It's Jim Cummings.
Yes. It's Jim Cummings, who's like amazing, you know.
amazing actor, yeah.
Yeah, it's the voice of so many beloved characters like Winnie the Pooh and Tigger and, you know, but as far as like the modern, you know, the voice today of those characters. And I love that, you know, Jim Cummings is, you could say he could sing as Scar and Rasputin. I mean, how many people can claim?
Exactly. I know, it's so fun.
Oh, in Pocahontas, but also he's the voice in Tarzan, right? Isn't he? Isn't it the same voice? I'm probably totally getting it wrong. But it's the
for Clayton and Radcliffe, or
I believe so. Yeah, I think it's the same voice. I'm shameless. I'm gonna look it up. I'm gonna go IMDb. Don't judge me. No, not Daniel.
That's what Tarzan was missing, was a Clayton villain song, I think.
Yeah, but it's, I think it was the same.
Not really.
Well, not, yeah. No, it's, who's the voice of Frollo in Hunchback? That's, I'm gonna look it up. I'm going to look it up. Who is the voice?
Oh, I guess we can't talk about villain songs without bringing up Hellfire, which is like the Disney outlier. Andrew, you can take this one. You worked on Hunchback.
Yes, please do. I'm curious.
There was a few moments during my 15 years there where I could literally go home and tell my wife, I think I just saw one of the most astounding things I've ever seen. And one of those was the first time I saw Hunchback, and most of it was still in storyboards, and they had rolled it out to the Florida team. And I remember that song playing, and I was like, I was literally blown away. I went, I cannot believe that the directors Kirk and Gary are taking this to here. I'm like, this is not the Little Mermaid. You know, this is this is not Hercules. And I was blown away, and that's probably why I'm forever will be their fans. Those guys, I love the movies that they direct. I was astounded as to where they were willing to take it. I don't know who they had to pay off to get that made, but it was pretty impressive. And I will have to dovetail and say the other moment for me and was when I walked out of the first screening of The Lion King, because that was the first time. I remember walking out, and I was in camera at the time, and I turned to my mentor, and I said, that movie's going to blow up. And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, that movie's not going to do that well. I'm like, no, dude, I'm going to disagree with you. That movie's going to move people like they've never been expected. They've never been moved before. And so shout out to Andrew. I called that one.
I remember Tom talking about that too, about how like, cause they let the Florida studio take a lot of stuff that was being done on The Lion King rather than leave the one in LA to do it. And part of it was because they didn't think The Lion King was going to be the money shot.
Right, it was going to be Pocahontas, right?
Right, that was what they were putting all of their focus on, which is so funny to me because nothing against Pocahontas, but I've always liked Pocahontas. I actually like probably enjoy it a little bit more than The Lion King, but I can recognize majesty the Lion King has. Wow. You know, like it's.
I'm not gonna disagree with you, but
I will.
I don't know. I haven't watched either in a long time. I haven't seen the last Lion King I saw was the live action version, so I need to detox myself and get something else in my brain. That's the last thing. That's probably what's affecting me there.
A little uncanny valley toxicity.
The uncanny valley. I have always enjoyed Pocahontas, but I don't know why they didn't think Lion King would overshadow it. I mean, there's something incredible about Lion King. And then like the lessons in Lion King, I mean, like the whole Rafiki thing where he hits Simba on the head and he's like, it's in the past. You can either learn from it. And he swings again and Simba ducks. He's like, see, you can learn from it or be hurt by it. And you learn from it. I was like, that's brilliant. That's genius.
I was one of those kids. I was probably about 9 or 10 years old, I think, when it came out and I saw it in theaters, and that, you know, the first time you see the sun rising and the song that hits you, and then the movie all the way, you know, to the ending and the credits where I heard Elton John, I think for the first time in my life, it was like kind of the film equivalent of a religious experience for me. Like you're just kind of like crying, like, you know, like that's a, for me as a 9-year-old kid, like to have that kind of experience at a movie, I'd never had that before until, you know, that was the first time I'd ever experienced something like that. Andrew, I wonder if you can talk about, just on a technical side of it, when you say that you were a camera operator, I wonder if you can talk about that in detail and maybe give our listeners an idea of what that means and what that entails, and maybe where they can see your work specifically in The Lion King.
You could basically see my work across the spectrum, because what would really happen especially on The Lion King, is I would shoot a lot of pencil tests. So basically the artist would order a pencil test. They would drop the scene off in camera. I would take it, shoot at the film, and we'd send the film off to be processed that night. And it would be back usually the next day for dailies, where everybody sits down in the whole studio and watches everything, all the footage that was pushed out for the week. So I touched a lot of scenes at that point. And that was where we were starting to transition to digital and using the CAP system. So if people don't know, the CAP system was originally the computer animation paint system. And it evolved to just this whole production system. And at that point in time, I think California had it, and really the Florida studio hadn't gotten on board with the technology yet, get our own stations and everything, or we were in the process. I don't remember exactly, but I was shooting a bunch of pencil tests to film. So I would have to do the camera moves and all that stuff. Basically, you'd lay the drawings down one frame at a time. You would backlight them so they could, you know, be visible for the film camera when you expose the frame. And yeah, really, really technical stuff. Tons of math. One of those things, I didn't think I'd use that much math when I was taking algebra, and I ended up using a whole bunch of math, you know, figuring out scene planning and camera moves. And actually, you kind of, you'll see a lot of that. I'm going to dovetail to the flower. You'll see a lot of that
because
a lot of the scenes in the flower are very camera focused, where the flower is going down the river, and we've got these
and
nice
really
camera
cool.
moves. And it's really cool.
I'm allowed to say that because I didn't actually work on it. That's not a plug. That's just a genuine opinion.
No, yeah, I think that's the thing with that people, I think, who aren't familiar with film language, and not that I think I'm familiar with it, but like that I have an appreciation for it, is that the camera as a character, or the camera as something to bring our attention to something of importance, and to follow and track things. You know, it's one thing to just take your camera out that you have in your, on your phone, and just like pan around. But the time and the painstaking operation of doing that with animation, you've got to, you, like you're saying, it takes a lot of planning and a lot of, it's a very technical thing to achieve something that maybe we think is very simple. You know, but it's also, it's always motivated by drawing attention to the story and drawing attention to, you know what I mean? Like has that ever been like foremost in your thinking when it comes to animation, as your background as a camera operator, and how that moves? Or is it sort of like a culmination of all of the disciplines in a way?
It's a little bit of both, but specifically like when it does come to camera, one of the big rules in camera that I learned from the get-go was the character always leads the camera. The camera should never lead the character. Mm-hmm. And so if you see the camera start to move before, like, you know, watching Simba walk, you know, then you've done the camera move wrong, because the camera move should be following the character as he starts to exit, either to the left or to the right, or whatever the case may be. A good camera move basically will not bring attention to itself, but it will, as you say, it'll accentuate what's going on screen. So if you notice the camera move, then it's kind of like, well, you know, that's a little bit getting in your face, and it might have a tendency to pull people out of the story. But if you can use camera moves to, you know, to plus something, to take a scene and plus it just a little bit more, then you're using it effectively. At least that's what I learned in my book in my animation days.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the idea of plussing something is very, that's so key to what makes Disney just a little bit better. And, you know, when they put out an animated film, they go that extra mile, or however, you know, whatever the terminology is for measuring the distance, but they go the distance, you know, like in Hercules.
Hey,
I love that, the idea that it would be character motivated, and that if it draws attention to itself and distracts you from the story, then you're probably doing it wrong. I would imagine that's probably the lesson.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about. Because I'll go back and I'll watch Disney films as an adult, I guess, and then it's like, wow, I never noticed this camera movement, or what this was doing, like where it was like rack focusing on, you know, the foreground elements, or with multiplane or whatever, you know. But that's, I guess that is, you know, if you don't notice it as a kid, then you were hooked on into the story. You were hooked into, but we are getting way off topic, because we were going to talk about Disney villain songs. I wonder, you said Fallon, that, you had a list, like a top 10, was it a list of villains or villain songs? I'm curious.
It was just a little blog post I was having fun with. It was a list of top 10 villains from like any franchise, okay, as long as they were animated. So there was a lot more than just Disney on there, but there were a lot of Disney ones. But the Rasputin is absolutely at the top, though. Like if we're going for villain songs, and since he's Disney now, I can say this, and I don't have to like put a disclaimer. He absolutely is number one.
Well, I think that's a great choice, you know, especially now that it's legit. Now you
that really song can... is like, it still to this day creeps me out. Like I can be listening to it, and I'm just like, ooh, I got like heebie-jeebies. Like he's coming for me. Like it's just, it is such a good song. I think if we were going down the line, I don't know. I think Hellfire needs to be up there too, definitely, just mm-hmm. because of just the nature of what that song is. And I've always liked to be prepared. I think Mother Knows Best is very clever. I don't love it as like a villain song, like I do Hellfire and in the dark of the night, but I think it's very funny. It fits her character very, very well.
Well, yeah, she's got such swagger, and right. That goes a long, long way. When
it does. And Friends on the Other Side. I'm a huge Keith David fan, so I have to say that one's that's high on my list as well. And I'm kind of blanking on other ones right now. But yes, Dr. Facilier. I'm like, oh yes, I want to hear Keith David sing about voodoo shadow magic. Like, yes, let's do it.
Oh man, yeah, and I think that's that. When you think of The Princess and the Frog, really, you can't talk about, you know, Disney 2D animation without. I don't want to say it was like the last gasp, but it's like, boy, I would love for them to do just one more, like just another like full length, you know.
Oh, 2D. Me too.
I would absolutely love. I would love to see like that was wow. How long ago was that? 2009 when that came out?
I think so. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. And, you know, I feel like I'm sounding like a fuddy-duddy when I say, you know, the CGI films are ruining everything, which is not the case, but at the same time, I think it's just solidifying, like The Flower, for instance. It obviously has an appeal because people love 2D animated film. It's because it's more rare. There's a rarity to it. And that makes, if anything, that makes it more special. Which is, you know, I feel like we should have appreciated it in its time. You know what I mean? When it was contemporary to like the next Disney animated movie was going to be 2D animation with aspects of computer, computers, at least, you know, in a supporting role, but not like featured. But yeah, now I'm getting off topic again. That's the great part.
Wait, we haven't heard from Andrew. Like, hold on, you got to weigh in on the villain songs because I've been talking way too much about it. Yeah, tuning in. They're tuning in to hear about The Flower, and I'm over here like, by the way, Rasputin rocks. Like,
I mean, no, I have to go with Hunchback. Literally, that was impressive.
Yeah, Hellfire is it's got to be in the top five for me.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I'm one of those where when it comes to a villain song, like a villain song as song, I mean, I love the older creepy ones, you know, or even like Cruella de Vil, like that's a classic kind of song. But I have to go with Gaston. I feel like that's really like the epitome of like the villain song is like, here's a dude where in the story, he's kind of pitched as maybe someone you would aspire to be like if you were a guy or to be with if you were a girl, but then by the end of the movie he's so revealed his true colors fully, like he's just the worst. I think that's kind of like the epitome of a Disney villain, is where he's kind of like the OG Disney twist villain that we're getting nowadays, where it's he's kind of not really pitched as the villain. He's just kind of obnoxious. And then
he's a good example of a Disney twist villain. I don't love a lot of their twist villains, but I Gaston is a great example of like, oh, this is how you introduce. And actually from my favorite movie, which I think is technically Disney now, cause it was George Lucas's property, but Strange Magic. And if anyone has ever heard of that, you rock. But if you haven't, go watch it. It's terrible and you'll love it. But the villain on there, he's got huge Gaston energy, and like it was the same way. He was introduced as the prince. He literally is the knight in shining armor. That is how you meet him, and then you find out he's like garbage. And I totally agree with you. I love that. I love you being presented with like this epitome of physiognomy, and then you're like, oh no, he's terrible. Never mind.
Yeah. I think that's when I think of like the Disney villain. I don't, you know, usually it's more of like you're saying, like eerie or creepy or obviously bad, but then when this epitome of masculinity, or you know, it's like you're saying, it's like, wow, the Beast is not the bad guy here. The Beast is the good guy, and he just has to come around to, you know, Belle's way of what she sees in him and all this.
That is my jam, and I'm actually wearing a Beauty and the Beast shirt right now. I dressed up for the occasion, like, so yes, I'm
there you go. It all comes together, you know.
Yes.
I'm especially good at expectorating. There you go.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Three cheers.
That's one of my favorite movies.
The version in the live action version with Josh Gad, I thought was hilarious.
They did a really good job. I love the live action movie, but Gaston was one of the shining lights in it for me, honestly. Him and LeFou were like so well done. Did I say his name right? LeFou? I think I messed that up.
LeFou.
Because Josh Gad. Josh Gad. He was just dressed up. It was Josh Gad in a costume.
G-A-S-T. I believe there's another T. And I just realized that I'm illiterate. And I've never had to spell his name out loud before.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But I know it's LeFou because at Disney World, they have a drink that's sort of a low-key competitor to Butterbeer. It's not as good as Butterbeer, I have to say.
Oh, dear.
But it's called LeFou's Brew. And you can get it in Fantasyland at Disney World. So gotcha. I'm probably going to cut out the part where I sang because that was kind of
I loved that. I thought that was fun.
Well, okay.
Now I'm thinking about it, I'm like, you probably should cut out the part where I said that I think I enjoyed Pocahontas more, because I don't think I did. I'm not sure. I was thinking about it after I said it. I was like, wait, no, I did like The Lion King better. I just have the live action still in my head. And I'm like, no, I didn't enjoy that at all.
That's fair. But you know what? I do like Pocahontas. I feel like it's a really underrated. And I think it's one of those things where it doesn't do well at the box office. And then that sort of defines the tastes of people is because it wasn't successful. And like, what does that even mean? Like, we have cult classics that didn't do well at all. And now everybody loves them because what's good wins out over time rather than what is programmed to be successful from the get-go and makes $1 billion. I'm not looking at you, Frozen. I'm just saying that.
This is a positivity podcast. We can't talk about Frozen.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
No, I'm kidding.
Boy, wow. Well, you know what?
I respect Frozen, but I don't have to like it.
I respect the tar out of Frozen. I think they did such a great job, and I think that the fact that it had such a big impact on the culture, like it's
right. Yeah.
But that's the power of Disney in a way that they've had to change with the times, and they've always stayed relevant. At the heart of all their stories is, as we've discussed, there is that element of inspiring hope in people, and it keeps people coming back again and again. And I think that with this project, The Flower, I will say I went on YouTube and I was watching sort of an animatic version of the film that's there. And I was just blown away by what I saw there. In addition to what the Kickstarter has, the information that's on there, I'm excited to see this come to fruition. I'm excited to, you know, what is the goal once the film is complete? Where do you see this going? What do you see happening with the film ultimately?
Festival circuit. Absolutely.
Yeah. Because my wife's a director and, you know, she had a film and we followed it around. We kind of went around the country and went to the screenings and have met so many awesome people through that. And it's gone places. And I wish the best for this film because it looks like it's going to be amazing. And what do you hope that people, when we talk about, you know, inspiring hope in people in an audience, what do you hope that people will take away from The Flower?
The same thing that the audience took away from when Snow White and the Seven Dwarves actually was on screen years ago. People cried in the theater, and nobody had ever thought that an animated movie would actually touch people in such a way so deeply as that, to actually bring them to tears. That's really my goal. If I can reach out and somebody goes, that's a beautiful piece of art, then I've done what I set out to do, is to move people and for people to take maybe a moment and appreciate the beauty that's around them.
I think that's wonderful. I and just the fact that it is animation, that medium, I think it kind of inspires an unguardedness in people, because when it's a cartoon, they kind of let their guard down in a way in terms of what they can expect from it. And then when it does move them, like you're saying, people will find themselves, you know, overwhelmed. And that's what I love about animation. And it's, you know, Disney animation time and time again. I expect nothing less from The Flower when it is completed. I encourage you guys to go out and, well, not go out, stay, you know, you can stay home or you can go out and get on your phone and please check out the Kickstarter campaign for The Flower, 2D animated film. Can you give us the link so that people can find it exactly? Obviously, I'm going to put it in the show notes, but maybe if they can hear it as well, they can know exactly where to find it.
Yes. So if you go on Kickstarter and you search The Flower, a 2D animated short film, you'll find this. And it's under, like, if you go to the film section on Kickstarter and then you go in the animation tab, it's one of the first results. I think it still is since it became a project that Kickstarter loved, that it tends to be one of the first ones at the top. And we have until the very early time of 7:30 Central on May 15th to meet our goal. So, which is about 15 days from the time that we're recording this right now. But yeah.
Hopefully you are inspired by this conversation we've had and you'll go and check it out. And I'm going to be contributing as well. And I'm so happy to have had you both on. It's kind of rare, you know, that we get to talk about 2D animated film in a relevant way. You know what I mean? It's usually sort of in hindsight, but the fact that this is being made right now is kind of exciting. And it's part of Disney history, and I encourage you guys to be part of it. So I always ask my guests this, what song should we end with? I know we were talking about Disney villain songs. Which one should we end with?
I think Andrew should pick it. This is his deal. So,
absolutely, Little Mermaid, Part of Your World.
Oh, I think that's great. I think because of course that was your first screen credit with Disney, correct?
That was my official first screen credit. Yes, I was actually working at a freelance ink and paint company before Disney hired me, and so I did touch a frame or two of Oliver and Company.
Okay.
I did. Maybe a little Roscoe and DeSoto in there, but Little Mermaid was the first official credit. I was very, very excited and very young.
That's amazing. You're going to be hearing now from Little Mermaid, Part of Your World. And I want to thank you guys again for coming on the show. Thank you, Andrew. And thank you, Fallon.
Yes. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you just having us come on and be able to share, and thank you for having us.
All right, and I always end the show this way. I am Spaceship and you're not, but that's okay because you're you. See ya. Looking around here, you think, sure, she's got everything. I've got gadgets and gizmos aplenty. I've got who's its and what's its galore. You want thingamabobs? I got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more. I want to be where the people are. I want to see them dancing, walking around on those, what do you call them? Oh, feet. Flipping your fins, you don't get too far. Legs are required for jumping, dancing, strolling along down a, what's that word again? Street. Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they stay all day in the sun, wandering free. Wish I could be part of that world. What would I give if I could live out of these waters? What would I pay to spend a day warm on the sand? Betcha on land, they understand that they don't reprimand their daughters. Bright young women, sick of swimming, ready to stand and ready to know. People know, ask them my questions and get some answers. What's a fire and why does it, what's the word, burn? When's it my turn? Wouldn't I